Today, I spoke with James McSweeney from the 131 School of Composting, also the author of Community Scale Composting. We jammed so much in this episode, starting with what the 131 School is all about, particularly the Compost Operator Certificate Program. His book, which came out in 2019, and James's vision of composting in the future. James then turns the tables on me and asks me questions about Austria's model of composting. At some point, we forgot we were being recorded, and the conversation just flows until I realize we both have prior engagement starting in 1 minute. Classic. I can't get enough of this knowledgeable compost community. We are learning so much from each other. Welcome to The Composter, a podcast for farmers and composters. I'm your host and fellow composter, Jane Murner. Join me in practical conversation between industry professionals and farmers with a passion for producing high-quality compost. We're going to dig deep into the science, technology, and art of compost production so that we as composters can help enliven the world's soils. This episode of the Composter Podcast is brought to you by High Country News. High Country News is an independent, nonprofit publication that has been covering the Western United States for more than 50 years. HCN provides unique on-the-ground reporting on the land, water, wildlife, and communities of the region with dedicated coverage of climate, environmental, and indigenous issues. Sign up for free newsletters or a trial of the magazine at hcn.org/no-till. This episode is also brought to you by the Culinary Breeding Network and Glenwood. On Monday, October 16th, from 4 to 8 p.m. at Glenwood Center for Regional Food and Farming in Cold Spring, New York, there will be an engaging evening of conversation, learning, and tasting brought to you by the Culinary Breeding Network and Glenwood. The Variety Showcase is designed to create connections among plant breeders, seed growers, farmers, chefs, bakers, distillers, retailers, distributors, and consumers. That's all of us. Attendees will have the unique experience to taste new and in-development vegetable, fruit, and grain cultivars. They can engage in conversation, share opinions, and take part in breaking down the walls between eaters and breeders. Tickets are available on both Culinary Breeding Network and Glenwood websites. Enjoy the show. Hey, James, welcome to The Composter.
Hi, James. Thank you.
I'm so glad you joined me. My crew, two of my crew members took your 131 School of Composting class last winter and really enjoyed it and learned a lot. And I wanted to ask you some questions about it. Like, what led you to start this 131 School of Composting? By the way, I love the name.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. There's been some controversy about the name because, you know, some people really like that there's a number associated with pathogen reduction. 131, it's, you know, it's nice to have a number, but it is a bit ambiguous because pathogen reduction happens, of course, at 130 and 129, yeah. 128. But yeah. But I wanted people to walk away remembering that number.
Perfect.
As a starting point from the school. But I'm glad you asked me this question because it has caused me to sort of look backwards at the history of sort of what brought this. It's the written word is really my personal comfort zone. You probably know I have a book called Community Scale Composting, and I consider myself a compost educator and consultant. I do a lot of written reports and that sort of thing. But the teaching is an amazing experience. Like, you know, it takes me out of that comfort zone. We all have like different aspects of our personality. I'm an introvert. But I get really excited as I'm gearing up to teach. In over a 3-week period right now, I'm doing like five different public speaking things. This is one of them. Mm-hmm. And then I'm doing 3 all day trainings. I get invigorated by that. It's also, a bit exhausting, but I had a realization during COVID, so stepping back, and I've been doing a very similar training to the 131 Schools Compost Operator Certificate since 2011 in Vermont. And that was mostly an in-person training. It was all-day training. And we covered most of the same things. And so it's like this curriculum has really been developed in practice. Teaching it since 2011, I think we're probably around, we're 10 or 11 for that training. But around, I want to say 2018, I started to recognize the need for online curriculum for remote learning. And then I believe it was 2019, we piloted sort of a hybrid version of the Vermont training where we did some remote in preparation for classroom, because we just like in a day there's only so much you can cover a lot. Yeah. But it always feels like we're trying to cram too much in, and that was the feedback we got. So we tried doing sort of a hybrid, like do the first 2 units of the course remotely, do some take a review quiz, come in. And so I had started to create this remote content when COVID hit.
Perfect timing.
Yeah. And it was, sort of my intention all along to be like, okay, we can move this more and more online, still do in-person trainings, because you can't replace the value of in-person trainings, obviously. Mm-hmm. I mean, that connection that's happening just between the students, the participants, is so valuable. So COVID hit, and then I believe it was late 2020, we did our first fully remote training, and we opened it up to the world for the first time. The Vermont training is really focused on Vermonters. We let a few out-of-staters in, but we opened it up to the world and had a big class come in. It was a great group. And it was just like, couldn't have come at a better time, right? Like people connecting across the country in this, the height of COVID. So, that really lit the fire for me. And was for me personally a way to connect with all these folks, many of whom I knew and had developed relationships with, and then to be able to connect. But it's, I'm a consultant. I've worked remotely for almost 10 years. So this whole remote work thing is not a new thing for me. Mm. And it's lonely. And I can tell you, like, something beautiful happens when we connect with people around composting. Mm. Even if it's remote. I love the in-person stuff, but the 131 school is sort of, for me, just like, people need this. It's a way to connect. It's a way to, build, relationships and teach, and I think it also, there's a point at which I realized, like, in my consulting work, how many of my clients need to take a training.
Yes.
Like, I just can't teach them everything. We talk about developing their site and their plans, but like, I can't go into the depth of like C to N ratios with every individual, right?
Yeah.
It's hands down, like, educating composters about the basics is hands down the best investment. Best way to sort of just in the most efficient way to teach people these basic pieces. And I love it. There's an esoteric aspect of it. Like, I literally have trouble talking about like the miracle of photosynthesis and the carbon cycle without like a tear coming in my eye, because it's amazing. Like, talking about rotting stuff like gives me a shiver.
I know. I'm right there with you.
It's funny how, you know,
I mean, science and miracles are so intertwined. I consider myself a scientist, but it's all so miraculous. It's like hard to not be blown away and you know, feel like the awe of it all. It's amazing. So
So that's the roots. Yeah,
that's so great. I have Community Scale Composting, excellent book and beautiful pictures, and well done. What year did that come out? Is that before the trainings or during?
That was 2019.
Oh, okay, that's new.
Yeah, it was like the winter, or I think it was January 2019. So it's pretty new. Yep,
that's great. All right, so talk to us about like the guts of 131 Schools program. When does it start up next? Who did you design it for? You know, that kind of like the nuts and bolts.
Sure. So our flagship training is an operator certificate. It's a combination of videos and Zoom sessions. The videos people can do at their own pace. And registration is open right now for a January, February session. So as soon as people register, they can start the videos. And then in January and February, we have four Zoom sessions that are two question and answer and then two operator discussions. One of which is with someone named Jane Murner, who you may not have heard of. And the other, so I'm excited about that.
Yeah, me too.
The other is with Lisa Doherty from Juno Compost.
She's fantastic too.
And these are like big parts of the training. To me, it's really the highlight, is because we can't get out to a compost site, right? So, but it's pretty cool to hear composters just talk about what they know. Like, they're not talking about a specific subject. It's like just talking about what they know best, which is how they operate their site, how they built their systems. And so to me, it's a really exciting format, and we record them, and then we have another free a free course called the Operator Discussion Series that are sort of edited versions of those, shortened. And we rotate through, like right now, Michael Martinez from LA Compost has his talk up there. But we have Carl Hammer, was the last one, Tom Gilbert from Black Dirt Farm. So we kind of cycle through past past presenters. Mm-hmm. You get a copy of my book with the course. It's really focused on food scrap composting. Mm-hmm. Obviously relevant. I mean, composting is composting, no matter what the materials. It's all about knowing the materials, right? That you're working with and managing appropriately. So it covers, compost principles, systems, recipe, feedstocks, blending, pile formation, monitoring, management, maturity, troubleshooting, neighbor relations, site stormwater, process water management, those basics in some depth. And then there's exercises to where people can actually use recipe calculator to develop either a real recipe for themselves or sort of a hypothetical recipe. There's some other work related to regulations and we really encourage people to get out to compost sites.
That's great. I know a couple of your students have ventured over here and cited, you know, that James encouraged us to go to our sites, and that's why I'm coming by. So it's working, whatever you're saying.
I'm glad. Yeah, that's a really important part of it. Encouraging people to network, you know, with other composters. Composters are generally very open, right, to like having folks come in and check out what they're doing. So
and you learn so much. But every time I go to a compost facility, I learn so much. Just you gotta have boots on the ground and see it and smell it and feel it and all the things. Right. So that's such a good part of it.
Right. And I mean, and that's the other thing about teaching. Like, you learn so much when you're teaching. There's no better way to like really learn the subject matter than to teach it. But yeah, I mean, just a few other things. Like, it's a commitment. Like, I'd say it's probably somewhere in the 12 to 20 hour range, depending on how deep people want to go. They can go deeper than that. There's a ton of additional resources. I'd say like the target composter. Well, there isn't really a target composter, but I'd say we're really trying to find a niche in the medium scale. So from like, you know, I mean, really it's for anyone above the backyard compost scale.
Okay.
All the way up to, you know, commercial composters are getting a lot out of it, but it's really geared towards like the systems and practices that a small to medium scale food scrap composter are going to have. And I think that's sort of a niche that we're trying to fill, and we're trying to bring in a diversity of folks, you know, different backgrounds, different scales, different systems and different levels of experience. And, you know, some very experienced composters are sending their folks, you know, to check it out and have actually taken the course too, and said that they got a lot out of it. So it's definitely like really valuable to newer composters, but older composters are definitely gonna, it's a good refresher.
I love it, because I want this industry to just grow and get like more and more intelligent, and so we can all, like, I just want us all to move towards making better quality compost in a better way and managing sites. So we want all the education for everybody. And so I love, even I'm psyched that you have this program, and I want to guide everyone towards all the education that we can get.
And I highly recommend the like the week-long programs too, for people who are for people who are like really serious about this. Like, there's no replacement to doing a main compost school or one of the compost research education foundation classes. So yeah, this is definitely like a middle ground between like taking a master composter course and doing a week long thing. And it's really affordable, obviously, too. And do it your own pace. So I think of it as a complement to those trainings, and, you know, sort of maybe a lead up to those trainings in a way, for many people.
And we can learn about it for a lifetime. So much to learn.
That's the thing. It's always going to be a different group. You're always going to be learning from the people in that group. It's certainly a lifelong learning.
You must have a vision for the future of compost if you're really wanting to educate people about it. Can you talk to me about that, that vision you have? Your ideal vision.
Surely. Yeah. That's a big question. But I think, you know, it's something I've been talking about for many years. And I got my start in composting in Vermont, which has a really lively, composting community, a really established, well-established composting community. I couldn't tell you exactly how many composters there are. There's at least over 10 permitted sites, but if you count all the non-permitted sites and folks who are doing, on a smaller scale or just getting started, there's probably 30 or 40. And in 2014, they passed an organics ban, a universal recycling law that was very much focused on organics. And, you know, so it was back then that I started sort of asking the question, like, okay, what is this going to look like? Because other people are asking that question, like, what is this going to look like? And what I kept coming back to that it is very likely to look like what it already looks like, which is diverse and dispersed. And that's sort of still the vision that I that I hold on to. A decentralized network of composters, it creates strength in the composting industry when, we're not relying on one composter or digester, who, if they fail, it means, or if they get shut down, even temporarily, it means diverting all that material either to the landfill or potentially hundreds of miles away. Mm. I just really want to see the benefits of composting spread, as equally as possible, to a diverse group of stakeholders, of composters, processors, those who are receiving the benefits of composting by being able to divert their organic material. In terms of ownership, I would love to see more cooperative style ownership, whether that's worker co-ops, consumer co-ops, where the people who are out there having their food scraps collected are partial owners, like a CSA or a food co-op type model, producer co-ops where composters can group together for marketing purposes. And ideally, what are called hybrid or multi-stakeholder co-ops, where there's both worker ownership and, as part of a producer co-op. Mm. I think there's no reason why farms and users couldn't, be owners of composting businesses. I think, it's something that I come to, just recognizing the challenges for composters, to get started economically, to make a living, a good living, who are facing, animosity from communities and NIMBYism and, regulators at times. I think that the finding ways to engage communities to, support composting, socially, culturally, politically, and economically, I don't know that we have an ideal model for that. But I think if you look at internet co-ops or electrical co-ops, like composters are providing this public good.
Yeah.
And the benefits are so huge. The landfills just can't take it, you know? And that's a huge cost. Like once those lands built, those costs are just going to keep going up. Right.
And then it creates a beneficial product. I know we're speaking to the choir here. So we're, it's astronomically better. Like I would love to calculate the actual difference. It's huge. It's amazing.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's almost unquantifiable, but it is, you're right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I don't know what those models are going to look like. Really what we see so far as I'm aware for composters, there are worker co-ops. Mm-hmm. And those are amazing and they've been leading the way, but I'd like to see a more diversity of sort of that cooperative ownership model. And we need to find ways for composters to partner with local government.
Yeah.
And to be supported by local government without it being a government takeover.
Yeah.
Because you're seeing that happening more and more. The community composting industry, I'm sure this is happening beyond, there's a lot of concern there, and people have been investing in educating the community and sort of raising up composting as a solution for a long time. And there's, you know, so it's not that I think that government doesn't need to play a role. It certainly does. But, you know, trying to find a way to balance, you know, balance that role and also support and sustain these more grassroots and, you know, and commercial entities and farms. I'd love to see more, animals like involved in composting. I think that's a real niche. Like if you think about the EPA hierarchy and just generally the, you know, the highest and best use for, material that is food that had all this energy put into it to grow, like, you know, it being able to just cycle it right back into, eggs.
Yeah.
For example, makes a ton of sense. And, and there are models already of folks doing this, and making amazing compost.
Yeah.
Simultaneously. So I'd like to, you know, really see that more. And I think I like to talk about, the fact that we've done this before right here.
Yeah.
Right here. I live in Arlington in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. If you go into Cambridge, I haven't found any here in Arlington, but if you go into Cambridge or, you know, some of the surrounding communities outside of Boston, even inside of Boston, there are these concrete holes in the ground that have a metal cap that like a lid that has a foot pedal and you step on it. And people used to throw their food scraps down into there. Mm-hmm. And there was a bucket down there and you could lift the lid up and, pig farmers had contracts with the municipalities to collect those food scraps all around the Northeast. I don't know how widespread it was. I'm sure that there were parts of Rhode Island where you are where this existed. Definitely Massachusetts, definitely Connecticut. But like this was a model that there's still a few that have been doing it since the whenever, you know, I don't even know the history exactly. I know it mostly died off in like the 80s.
Yeah.
I think 70s, 80s. Something I'd love to just really research and get to the bottom of, like how this all works, because it's like a model of right in our own backyards.
Yeah.
I mean, not necessarily advocating for feeding pigs because there's challenges with that, but like but there's certainly nothing wrong with that if that's done sanitarily.
All right, everyone, important public service announcement. I know some of you are already making plans for how you'll spend the winter. Ordering tools, researching seeds, projecting crops. It's also a great time to gather with other farmers to share knowledge and skills. This February 22nd to 24th, join thousands of farmers like you and me from across the U.S. for 3 days of community building and farmer-led learning at the 35th Annual Marble Seed Organic Farming Conference. Save the date and find out more at marbleseed.org/conference. This episode is also brought to you by Viably, the master distributor of ComTech products in North America. For over 25 years, ComTech has worked with scientists, agriculture experts, and customers to develop a proven 4-step process that produces healthy, contaminant-free compost while optimizing commercial production efficiency. This process is known as shred, turn, screen, and separate. You can learn more about Viably at thinkviably.com. While you're there, request a complimentary consultation to discover if the ComTech process is right for your commercial operation. It's your host here, Jane. I have a ComTech Star screen, and it has seriously increased the efficiency of our screening process here at EarthCare Farm. Viably is proud to support the Composter podcast and is ready to help you make the most of a great opportunity. And now, back to the show. There's like two things I want to touch upon is that I totally agree with that hierarchy. We get like 30 tons of fish on this Thursdays here, and it's from a processor that most, if any fish that, you know, fish, the fish is harvested well and then sold to humans. And then whatever's left that is not for humans, as much as it can goes into pet food. And then we get the last. So it's like to compost, like
the
fins that there's no meat on it, and the head where there's nothing left. And I just love that. That's a beautiful hierarchy. Like, feels like it's really honoring that animal. And then the other part I wanted to touch upon was, we actually had a trial here in Rhode Island. There was a group that started, they had this idea to get a bunch of composters in Rhode Island, which there's not that many of us, and collaboratively market our compost as one thing, Rhodey Gold. And I loved the concept and the theory, and I wanted to be involved. And then it's so hard when you break it down. Each composter's quality was different. And then it just didn't work to combine all our composts and market it as one when the grades were so different. So there was just like challenges that come up with that kind of community style that are definitely things you can work out, but some of them harder than others when it comes to that kind of thing.
totally agree. I think they're, you know, the models in agriculture are obviously what we'd want to look to is that sort of how they achieve that quality control, you know? And of course, like, heard of folks talk about, okay, well, I'd only want folks who are following the Elaine Ingham method. It's like, you know, so there's certainly, like, it would have to be the right group of people, and there would have to be a lot of quality control.
Yeah,
to
make it work. Like the dairy industry, you know, there's milk, but it's a lot of cooperatives, and then there's like the biodynamic raw, like with the cream on top, you know. So yeah, there's totally different grades of that. I usually ask, what are the steps we can get to this vision of compost, which is already existing, but I think I'm going to switch it around and just say, like, what are the challenges that are preventing us from getting there, where this is so commonplace and everyone's doing it and we have all these different outlets of places we can do it and there's collections are worked out? What are we facing? What are our challenges that are preventing it?
Yeah.
I didn't ask. I didn't write this down, so I'm just throwing this away.
No, it's good. It's good. I think that where it is working, where we are seeing this type of really seeing compost growing, which is nearly everywhere at this point. Mm-hmm. But there are places where there are very much bigger challenges, I would say. And one of the biggest challenges is access to land, and the cost of land. Because if you don't have a place to compost, like, if you literally, you know, it takes land and it takes enough of a step back to really make this work. I mean, there's workaround, which is like, go smaller, right? Like, do it in an alleyway. And that certainly is something that people are doing, in cities around the world. But there's local zoning is a real issue for sort of growing, especially that small, you know, medium and large scale. And one of the areas of confusion is, like, is composting agriculture? Mm. And whether or not composting is agricultural activities are generally allowed by right on farms, on agriculturally zoned land. Mm. But how states interpret that and whether states are willing to back that up and how towns interpret that, mm-hmm. Is, you know, it's kind of a nightmare.
A lot of gray.
Yeah, a lot of gray, a lot of questions. Like, nobody knows. That's a huge, I mean, Vermont, which has been, I think, way ahead in a lot of ways, has only just now gotten protections for farms from local zoning. And even that's like a bit of a gray area to get people at the state to back that up. I'm not totally sure yet.
Yeah.
I think that they're there, but, like, yeah, it just, like, testing that is a real challenge. So, you know, it really, and this sort of brings me to like the other piece, which is where it's working. I think you really have grassroots efforts. Like it's individuals and coalitions coming together and saying, this is our vision for what this needs to, you know, what we want in our region. And we, you know, we want you, states and municipalities and the, you know, funders to get behind this and sort of help us move it forward. Mm. And I think that is like highly overlooked aspect of like how this change really happens. You know, you definitely also need groups like the U.S. Compost Council,
yeah,
to sort of move the conversation forward nationally. And they've been doing amazing work with like bringing in funding, but like where the rubber hits the road, how that funding actually gets allocated and spent, and whether or not it gets spent efficiently, and whether or not it just goes to like the big players, or, you know, is getting distributed to, you know, folks who have been historically disadvantaged and not supported by government programs. You know, I really am not a proponent of a world where BlackRock takes control of the organics processing infrastructure. Yes. Like that just doesn't, I mean, A, I just don't think it's going to work very well. And B, like, I mean, they're heavily invested in plastic, yes, manufacturing. Like those two are just sort of inherently at odds,
yeah,
right? So I just, you know, I just got to be frank about that. You know, it's like, this, we need to talk about these things, because I think as it becomes more and more mainstream, there's going to be more and more tension between sort of a decentralized vision for composting and whatever, you know, a more centralized version. And I think there's going to be both, but like ultimately what decentralized means is there is still room for decentralized. It's not just a centralized system. That's not the only place we're investing. It's sort of all of the above in a way. And I think we also need to like hold folks at the larger scale accountable for not polluting with microplastics and PFAS, and I mean, really at all scales, right?
Yeah, all scales. But, I've seen terrible small scale as well as big.
It's not just small scale, but I'm thinking directly of like the questions around depackaging that I think are really unanswered right now. We can't be making plastics smaller and smaller, and then allowing them to get through our screening systems and expect that to be a usable end product. We don't want like farms don't want it. Nope. Right. So there's a real risk there of like building infrastructure that becomes basically needs to be landfilled. material. So
we don't want to create more trash. Like we're composting. Yeah. Let's make compost.
I know that like, you know, one of the last times you and I talked, you sort of turned me on to what's happening in Austria.
Yeah.
And I've really like taken that to heart. I watched the ILSR has an amazing webinar with Florian Amlinger, which I would direct people to if they want to get sort of just a general sense of like what's happened there. But I wanted to ask you, I know you just got back from Austria.
I did.
And what ideas you brought back and what you saw. And yeah, I'm just really excited. I've been sort of talking about the Austrian model.
Yeah.
Really. And I think it's a really gives me a lot of hope to hear about how they've done it.
Yeah. And I did. So I spent 2 weeks there. 1 week was I got to visit Comtech's factories, their four factories, and kind of explore this lower area of Austria. And then the second week, I was with Florian Amlinger for the whole week with a study group. We visited at least a dozen compost facilities. And what happened there, and I do have a couple podcast episodes about this, but it's great for me to just talk about it a little bit because there I'm talking to other people. But in 1992, there was an organics ban, just like it's happened here, but I mean, way long ago. And just like here, there wasn't actually the infrastructure to absorb that organics ban. Just, okay, no more food scraps. They call it bio waste. You know, yard materials and food scraps can go to the landfill anymore. And each area of Austria, similar to states here, was just tasked with figuring out on their own what to do with that ban. And it's similar to here. I it was very relatable. So that's why I was so drawn to go there, because we're having that happen here in Rhode Island. And different states have done, you know, various jobs of doing that. I could focus on like some of the best areas that I saw, you know, that being done. And it does come down to the individual. So one where I really felt like they did an amazing job was one woman in the municipal waste management facility was there in the 90s and was like, okay, what do we do? And she sorted through their municipal waste and figured out what percentage was actually organics, and then had to do this data analysis of how to, you know, what savings it would be if they separated that out and brought it, you know, did digestion versus composting versus all different things, and realized the cost savings were going to be in composting. There was no compost farms. There was no compost operations in that area. So, but she realized that it was in that area, I think it was 24% of the trash was organics, and separating that out from their weekly collections that they did in the town. It wasn't just a town. It was like, I think like 30 towns was the area that they were. They could reduce the weekly pickup of trash to, it turned out now later on, it's once every 6 weeks they can pick up the trash because it's just so much less quantity and it doesn't, and it doesn't have odor because it's not, doesn't have the food making the odors that, you know, it would normally be in a mixed trash situation. So that was a huge cost savings for the town, just the reduction of pickups that way. And then what was the, there was just like some pretty amazing data that she was able to glean from figuring out how much was actually organics from their area's trash. And I can tell she was super humble, but she was then tasked with meeting with all the farmers and trying to get farmers to actually take in this material and compost it and do the trainings and, you know, education and all the things. And she was able to get six different farms in that area to take this on. They made it, you know, the I'm calling it towns, but it's called like their regions, were tasked with setting a tipping fee. So they would meet with the composters and say, you know, what does it cost? And so it's a little bit of a hybrid between like centralized and decentralized, where the state is setting the rate, just like it would be the rate for going to the landfill and dumping. Of the collections, and then the state, I'm going to call it state, is also tasked with communicating with the public all of the time of what is allowed, what isn't allowed, weekly publications, hotlines, apps. You know, you can take a picture of like, is this tea bag compostable or this kind of thing. So it kind of takes, that is for me as a composter, I have a lot going on just to make the compost. To think about all that public outreach is daunting, but to have that, have the state taking care of that is actually really helpful, I think, that partnership. Yeah. And in that region, the composters actually did the pickup collection. Like I don't do that here. It's all, we have trucking companies that are lots of different independent ones, but that was actually a great model. Because the composter himself or herself is, you know, you see those drivers. You see they're going to pick up. Usually it's once a week, sometimes every 2 weeks, depending on seasons and things. And oh, you know, hey George, you know, last week there was something in your compost that, you know, didn't work well with our system, and then George wants to make that better, and and there's a little bit more of a communication. And also everyone knows that composter and that's where they get their compost for their gardens. You know, it was the gardening scene in Austria was strong, even in the cities. So there's that little bit more of a connection. Those were the regions I found the best quality made compost was where the state was responsible for some parts of it, like the tipping rate and the communications and help support, just supporting. And then the composter had free rein with some things and they did the collections as well and they made the compost. The regulations there, I think there's only one way to make right compost in Austria, where you know here there's a lot of different right ways to make compost, and the pile can only be 1.3 meters and no higher, and has to, you know, all these. It was very, very regulated and monitored, and inspections about how to do that. That would be tough here.
Right.
Like there's, those short piles are really hard if you're taking in a giant tuna carcass. You just can't do that.
Right. And it's, especially in colder environments, and also just like you really have to at that size things are going to dry out, and it's like just controlling moisture would be really
Every site had a watering truck, you know. I think that the rules that they've set, in my opinion, made for the composters needing more infrastructure, needing more equipment. And so it's more expensive and, you know.
Which I would love to see more, better infrastructure on compost sites. But there's got to be a balance. And I think that the state there probably helped support with some of that infrastructure funding.
Yes. And there was funding for sure. Like, you know, especially the startups, and they made it tempting for the farmers to want to take on these tasks. It wasn't perfect. There was a lot of contamination still at many of the sites. Some were better than others. They're big on the separators. Like the one that got the Composter of the Year award while we were there, we got to see the ceremony. You know, they had this equipment to. The stuff that came in was so trash heavy, the inputs to come in. And then they had this, you know, magnetic thing to pull out any iron. And then they had infrared to pull out plastics that are not able to be lifted with the wind sifter. And it was like a 6-step process of separating out the trash, and a lot of trash being separated out. And then still there's trash in it, you know, at the end. And it was cool to see all that equipment, but I would much rather have that money spent on just educating the public on not having the trash in there in the beginning, and the supply. I don't know. Companies that making food products, like, we just need less packaging or different kinds of packaging. So,
absolutely.
That's what's the solution we really want? Is it more and more equipment for separating trash, or just let's reduce the trash?
Right. Well, investing in education is a long term investment, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's, you know, it, once people know, I think they generally don't need to be taught again sometimes, but
was encouraging is that, you know, this has been over 30 years, and so there's a whole second generation that's just grown up with this happening, and it's much more second nature, and that just where they need to concentrate efforts is in the cities where there's, or, you know, areas where there's new people moving in, there's some immigration happening, and so concentrate the education efforts in these pockets where it's people that haven't grown up with it. And having, that was one thing they realized, is there wasn't pamphlets in many languages. It was all in German. And so there's, you know, new populations coming in from Syria and different places. And here it needs to be in many languages as well, you know, and signs without words that are really clear of what can and can't go in there. And I just found it in the streets. There's, you know, I would like to look in people's bio bins, they call them, and see if I could, you know, what kind of contamination there was. And sometimes they were pretty awful, and sometimes some areas were like super clean. So it is, I think education is the really big thing. But I was encouraged. There's a lot of really encouraging things. I'm still, like, it's been a couple weeks I've been back, and I'm still processing so much.
I'm sure. So to recap, like, it sounds like the model is a public-private partnership where the farmers are the, sort of the private processors, and in many cases are doing the collection. And then there's the state that's doing a lot of education around source separation and sort of coordination. And then are the municipalities, that sounds like they're helping make the connections with the farms. Are they playing like a role as well on an active basis?
So that's where the wording is a little bit tricky, because when I'm saying state, I'm actually meaning it would be a cooperative of municipalities. That
way. I see.
So they set that. Nothing is set by like the country of Austria.
It's kind of like a waste district.
Yes, sort of. Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. It was hard to translate what that word would be because it's not the same as here. But yeah. I think I'm using state because it would be like 30 towns, you know, that would collaborate and decide how to treat their waste. And each area was actually really different. Some really focused on anaerobic digestion. And energy, and then others on composting or a hybrid of both. All of the I know we're about compost, but all of the recycling plants were amazingly organized with, you know, 90 different materials separated out and super clean. And they're actually, those municipalities are making money on the their recycling because it was so high quality. That is a model we really need to bring here. But I don't know. I was very much encouraged, and it did there was a lot of, it was, no operations were very big. What they considered big would be, you know, 10,000 yards produced or 10,000 yards of material even taken in a year. They were small. They were like, ours would be considered large there. And I think we're considered medium here. So I liked that model. There was a lot of small ones.
Right. I mean, I forget the numbers, like over 300.
Yeah,
composters. No,
yeah,
right?
I think they're at 400 composters, and there's 8 million people. Yeah,
and many of those are farms. Right?
Many of them were farms. Yeah, many of them are farms, which I love. I really enjoyed those models, particularly that extra income for the farm, the soils of that farm getting better. The farms that we visited, they made better compost in general than the more industrial, you know, sites. It's just that more, but not always, but just that better connection to soil health and things.
I had a really, made a really good connection with it. I'm not remembering his name, but with an Austrian at the U.S. Compost Council, and just was picking his brain. And, you know, one of the questions I think that comes up is like, when you get to a diversion rate of, I don't know what it is there, but it's pretty high, right? Like, will there be too much compost? And he said no. Like, people are still...
No.
Farms feel like they can still use more.
Yeah, this was so clear. So they said that if all of the world's organics were made into compost, we would only cover 2 to 3% of the world's agricultural lands. It is gold.
They're really big into soil testing. Like, they're really big into soil health and... Right, like they're monitoring nutrients and making sure they're not overloading nutrients.
Yes,
very closely.
Very conscious. Yeah, yeah. Because it's just, you know, the water. Everything has just been farmed for so much longer. That is really needed to keep an eye on all of that. You know, phosphorus levels and different things. So yeah, there's a lot we can take here. It is a different model. They've got, you know, it's a city with a country right outside with farms really close to cities. There's like things to apply. There's things that won't work here, but there's definitely a lot of lessons we could take. And the idea of the government supporting rather than just regulating, I really
like taking over.
Yeah, exactly. Is a model that could be applied, you know, and you know,
it seems like people, I don't know. It seems like there was very collaborative work happening between the public and the private sector. To make this happen. It's the only way I feel like it can really happen.
Yeah.
Honestly. and it sounds very similar to some of the models that we worked on up in Vermont and are still working on, where there's these solid waste districts, and they play that educational role either through like funding a nonprofit that does education. In Massachusetts, we have that. actually the state funds recycling works, which does education and supports businesses in composting. We don't really have it for the residential sector. Mm. That happens more municipality by municipality. But it's definitely a logical model, because, as you said, you know, it's hard for composters to. I mean,
you can't do everything. Yeah,
you can't do everything, and if you're doing the collection, it obviously you have to do some of that, right?
Totally. And I want to be conscious of the time. I know we have a couple of minutes, but I found the other day here, my dad has, you know, archives of ancient things, but a pamphlet from the early 90s from our state that was a home composting guide that our state had put out, and like good practices of home composting. That is incredibly valuable. I feel like, yes. If all our, we're in a really, you know, pretty residential neighborhood, but everybody could have a home compost here. And just a couple of little guidance to tips, and I think an app, you know, that can help people with that would be incredibly useful. That's right. Where the state could really help, is just education.
Absolutely. Totally. Yeah, I agree.
We had that in the
90s. I'm curious, in Austria, like, is that right? Yeah, I mean, do a lot of people just compost?
Yes.
In their backyards?
Yes. Like, and they had, like, there were some of the districts you had to, if you didn't have a collection for your bio waste, or I hate that term waste, but that you kind of had to show that you were home composting. So that is, and it was very much encouraged. So that was kind of great.
Right. Right.
James, I want to talk to you forever. And we have like 30 more seconds. Is there anything last minute that you really want to ask, or that you really want to let everybody know, or resource you're dying for everybody to know about in this last tiny bit together?
No, I mean, I have quite a few questions to ask you as well. The final thing, just since we're like, you know, going, we're just scraping the surface, right, on Austrian, on these different models. And, but one of the things that I found fascinating, that sort of, Florian pointed to in the ILSL, our webinar, and also that I learned about, at USCC, was that, like, they have amazing data tracking, and that's this other huge gap. Like I was talking with a municipal employee who they've been composting for 25 years and a really well established program. And I was like, what do you think your diversion rate is? And not going to name any names, but like they just had no idea. You know,
yeah,
It's really challenging to know, like, where to go if you don't know where you're at.
Totally.
And I mean, it sounds like in Austria, like they're tracking every bin that gets, you know, that can be like logged as a point uh-huh. to the truck, to the composter, to the finished composter, to the finished compost.
Yeah.
And they have really good data. And Florian said, you know, I don't know when it was, maybe 5 years ago, we got really good data, and the rate of diversion just really jumped after that. Mm. And because they had, I think it was partly, I don't know, partly maybe just more reporting, but it was definitely also like feedback, just knowing where the gaps were was really huge.
To see the data over 25 and 30 years was also amazing to see. And like,
right.
Yeah, that was so helpful. Each district so that we visited.
Tell that story, yeah. Right?
Like, and each district we visited was so proud to show. And it encouraged, right. Encouraged more. So there was like one district, 85% of their quote unquote trash was recycled either through composting or recycling. And they were so proud to share that, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And they're able to have the data to back it up.
That's for the data and policy geeks who are listening. Like, mm-hmm. That needs some work.
Yeah. Each state needs that data here. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. We have to talk so many more hours, and we both have things in the next 3 minutes.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Jane. This has been really fun.
It was a joy to have you on, James, and we'll be chatting soon, I'm sure. Okay. Appreciate you.
Thanks again.
Well, that was fun. If you're interested in the 131 School, check it out at the131school.com. There's a great free operator discussion series on the site that is well worth checking out, too. The book Community Scale Composting is widely available anywhere you buy books, really. And if you have any questions or show suggestions for me, I can be reached at info@earthcarefarm.com. You can also check us out on YouTube on our Earth Care Farm channel or Instagram at earthcarefarm_RI. Thank you to No-Till Growers for making this podcast happen, all the wonderful sponsors, the universe and all its mysterious benevolence, allowing me to do this fantastic work, and especially you compost-loving listeners. Until next week, which will be our last episode of the season, don't cry, I'm already lining up season 3.